Listening Library presents The Fever Code by James Dashner. Read for you by Mark Deakins. Prologue. Newt. It snowed the day they killed the boy's parents. An accident, they said much later, but he was there when it happened and knew it was no accident. The snow came before they did, almost like a cold white omen falling from the gray sky. He could remember how confusing it was. The sweltering heat had brutalized their city for months that stretched into years, an infinite line of days filled with sweat and pain and hunger. He and his family survived. Hopeful mornings devolved into afternoons of scavenging for food, of loud fights and terrifying noises. Then evenings of numbness from the long hot days. He would sit with his family and watch the light fade from the sky and the world slowly disappear before his eyes, wondering if it would reappear with the dawn. Sometimes the crazies came, indifferent to day or night. But his family didn't speak of them. Not his mother, not his father. Certainly not him. It felt as if admitting their existence aloud might summon them, like an incantation calling forth devils. Only Lizzie, 2 years younger but twice as brave, had the guts to talk about the crazies, as if she were the only one smart enough to see superstition for nonsense. And she was just a little kid. The boy knew he should be the one with courage. He should be the one comforting his little sister.
"Don't you worry, Lizzie. The basement is locked up tight. The lights are off. The bad people won't even know we're here."
But he always found himself speechless. He'd hug her hard, squeezing her like his own personal teddy bear for comfort. And every time, she'd pat him on the back. He loved her so much, it made his heart hurt. He'd squeeze her tighter, silently swearing he'd never let the crazies hurt her, looking forward to feeling the flat of her palm thumping him between his shoulder blades. Often they fell asleep that way, curled up in the corner of the basement, on top of the old mattress his dad had dragged down the stairs. Their mother always put a blanket over them, despite the heat, her own rebellious act against the flare, which had ruined everything. That morning, they awoke to a sight of wonder.
"Kids!"
It was his mother's voice. He'd been dreaming, something about a football match, the ball spinning across the green grass of the pitch, heading for an open goal in an empty stadium.
"Kids, wake up! Come see!"
He opened his eyes, saw his mother looking out the small window, the only one in the basement room. She'd removed the board his dad had nailed there the night before, like he did every evening at sunset. A soft gray light shone down on his mother's face, revealing eyes full of bright awe. And a smile like he hadn't seen in a very long time lit her even brighter.
"What's going on?"
he mumbled, climbing to his feet. Lizzie rubbed her eyes, yawned, then followed him to where Mum gazed into the daylight. He could remember several things about that moment. As he looked out, squinting as his eyes adjusted, his father still snored like a beast. The street was empty of crazies, and clouds covered the sky, a rarity these days. He froze when he saw the white flakes. They fell from the grayness, swirling and dancing, defying gravity and flitting up before floating back down again.
Snow. Snow. "What the bloody hell?"
he mumbled under his breath, a phrase he'd learned from his father.
"How can it snow, Mummy?"
Lizzie asked, her eyes drained of sleep and filled with a joy that pinched his heart. He reached down and tugged on her braid, hoping she knew just how much she made his miserable life worth living.
"Oh, you know," Mum replied. all those things the people say. The whole weather system of the world is shot to bits, thanks to the flares. Let's just enjoy it, shall we? It's quite extraordinary, don't you think?
Lizzie responded with a happy sigh. He watched, wondering if he'd ever see such a thing again. The flakes drifted, eventually touching down and melting as soon as they met the pavement. Wet freckles dotted the windowpane. They stood like that, watching the world outside, until shadows crossed the space at the top of the window. They were gone as soon as they appeared. The boy craned his neck to catch a glimpse of who or what had passed, but looked too late. A few seconds later, a heavy pounding came on the front door above. His father was on his feet before the sound ended, suddenly wide awake and alert.
"Did you see anyone?" Dad asked, his voice a bit croaky.
Mum's face had lost the glee from moments earlier, replaced with the more familiar creases of concern and worry.
"Just a shadow. Do we answer?"
"No," Dad responded. "We most certainly do not. Pray they go away, whoever it is."
"They might break in," Mum whispered. "I know I would. They might think it's abandoned. Maybe a bit of canned food left behind."
Dad looked at her for a long time, his mind working as the silence ticked by. Then,
boom, boom, boom.
The hard cracks on the door shook the entire house, as if their visitors had brought along a battering ram.
"Stay here," Dad said carefully. "Stay with the children."
Mum started to speak but stopped, looking down at her daughter and son, her priorities obvious. She pulled them into a hug, as if her arms could protect them, and the boy let the warmth of her body soothe him. He held her tight as Dad quietly made his way up the stairs, the floor above creaking as he moved toward the front door. Then silence. The air grew heavy, pressing down. Lizzie reached over and took her brother's hand. Finally, he found words of comfort and poured them out to her.
"Don't worry," he whispered, barely more than a breath. "It's probably just some people hungry for food. Dad will share a bit, and then they'll be on their way. You'll see."
He squeezed her fingers with all the love he knew, not believing a word he'd said. Next came a rush of noises. The door slammed open. Loud, angry voices. A crash, then a thump that rattled the floorboards. Heavy, dreadful footsteps. And then the strangers were pounding down the stairs. Two men, three, a woman, four people total. The arrivals were dressed sharply for the times, and they looked neither kind nor menacing, merely solemn to the core.
"You've ignored every message we've sent," one of the men stated as he examined the room. "I'm sorry, but we need the girl. Elizabeth, I'm very sorry, but we've got no choice."
And just like that, the boy's world ended. A world already filled with more sad things than a kid could count. The strangers approached, cutting through the tense air. They reached for Lizzie, grabbed her by the shirt, pushed at Mum, frantic, wild screaming, who clutched at her little girl. The boy ran forward, beat at the back of a man's shoulders. Useless. A mosquito attacking an elephant. The look on Lizzie's face during the sudden madness. Something cold and hard shattered within the boy's chest, the pieces falling with jagged edges, tearing at him. It was unbearable. He let out an enormous scream of his own and threw himself harder at the intruders, swinging wildly.
"Enough!"
the woman yelled. A hand whipped through the air, slapped the boy in the face, a snakebite sting. Someone punched his mother right in the head. She collapsed, and then a sound like the crack of thunder, close and everywhere at once. His ears chimed with a deafening buzz. He fell back against the wall and took in the horrors. One of the men shot in the leg, his dad standing in the doorway, gun in hand. His mum screeching as she scrambled off the floor, reaching for the woman who had pulled out her own weapon. Dad firing off two more shots, a ping of metal and the crunch of a bullet hitting concrete.
Misses both.
Mom yanking at the lady's shoulder. Then the woman threw an elbow, fired, spun, fired three more times. In the chaos, the air thickened, all sound retreating, time a foreign concept. The boy watched, emptiness opening below him, as both of his parents fell. A long moment passed when no one moved, most of all Mum and Dad. They'd never move again. All eyes went to the two orphaned children.
"Grab them both, damn it," one of the men finally said. "They can use the other one as a control subject."
The way the man pointed at him, so casually, like finally settling on a random can of soup in the pantry. He would never forget it. He scrambled for Lizzie, pulled her into his arms, and the strangers took them away. Chapter 1 2:21.11.28 9:23 a.m.
"Stephen! Stephen! Stephen! My name is Stephen!"
He'd been chanting it over and over to himself for the last 2 days, since they'd taken him from his mom. He remembered every second of his last moments with her, every tear that ran down her face, every word, her warm touch. He was young, but he understood that it was for the best. He'd seen his dad plummet into complete madness, all anger and stink and danger. He couldn't take seeing it happen to his mom. Still, the pain of their separation swallowed him, an ocean that had sucked him under, its coldness and depth never ending. He lay on the bed in his small room, legs tucked up to his chest and eyes squeezed shut, curled into a ball, as if that would bring sleep down on him. But since he'd been taken, slumber had come only in fits, snatches full of dark clouds and screaming beasts. He focused.
"Stephen, Stephen, Stephen, my name is Stephen."
He figured he had two things to hold on to: his memories and his name. Surely they couldn't take the first away from him, but they were trying to steal the second. For 2 days, they'd pressed him to accept his new name, Thomas. He'd refused, clinging desperately to the 7 letters his own flesh and blood had chosen for him. When the people in the white coats called him Thomas, he didn't respond. He acted as if he couldn't hear them, or as if he thought they were talking to someone else. It wasn't easy when only 2 people stood in the room, which was usually the case. Stephen wasn't even 5 years old, yet his only glimpse of the world had been full of darkness and pain. And then these people took him. They seemed intent on making sure he realized that things could only get worse, every lesson learned harder than the one before it. His door buzzed, then immediately popped open. A man strode in, dressed in a green one-piece suit that looked like pajamas for grown-ups. Stephen wanted to tell him he looked ridiculous, but based on the last few encounters he'd had with these people, he decided to keep his opinion to himself. Their patience was beginning to wear thin.
"Thomas, come with me," the man said.
"Stephen, Stephen, Stephen, my name is Stephen."
He didn't move. He kept his eyes squeezed shut, hoping the stranger hadn't noticed that he'd taken a peek when the man had first entered. A different person had come each time. None of them had been hostile, but then none had been very nice either. They all seemed distant, their thoughts elsewhere, removed from the boy alone in the bed. The man spoke again, not even trying to conceal the impatience in his voice.
"Thomas, get up. I don't have time for games, okay? They're running us ragged to get things set up, and I've heard that you're one of the last ones resisting your new name. Give me a break, son. This is seriously something you want to fight about? After we saved you from what's happening out there?
Stephen willed himself not to move. The result, only a stiffness that couldn't possibly look like someone sleeping. He held his breath until he finally had to suck in a huge gulp of air. Giving up, he rolled onto his back and glared at the stranger dead in the eye.
"You look stupid," he said.
The man tried to hide his surprise, but failed. Amusement crossed his face.
"Excuse me?"
Anger flared inside Stephen.
"I said you look stupid, that ridiculous green jumpsuit, and give up the act. I'm not going to just do whatever you want me to do, and I'm definitely not putting on anything that looks like those man jammies you're wearing. And don't call me Thomas, my name is Stephen."
It all came out in one breath, and Stephen had to suck in another huge gulp of air, hoping it didn't ruin his moment, make him look weak. The man laughed, and he sounded more amused than condescending. It still made Stephen want to throw something across the room.
"They told me you had..."
The man paused, looked down at an electronic notepad he carried.
"An endearing, childlike quality about you. Guess I'm not seeing it."
"That was before they told me I had to change my name," Stephen countered. "The name my mom and dad gave me. The one you took from me."
"Would that be the dad who went crazy?" the man asked. "The one who just about beat your mom to death, he was so sick? And the mom who asked us to take you away? Who's getting sicker every day? Those parents?"
Stephen smoldered in his bed, but said nothing. His green-clothed visitor came closer to the bed, crouched down.
"Look, you're just a kid. And you're obviously bright. Really bright. Also immune to the flare. You have a lot going for you."
Stephen heard the warning in the man's voice. Whatever came next was not going to be good.
"You're going to have to accept the loss of certain things and think of something bigger than yourself," he continued. "If we don't find a cure within a few years, humans are done. So here's what's going to happen, Thomas. You're going to get up. You're going to walk with me out that door, and I'm not going to tell you again."
The man waited for a moment, his gaze unwavering. Then he stood and turned to leave. Stephen got up. He followed the man out the door. Chapter 2 221.11.28 9:56 a.m. When they entered the hallway, Stephen got his first glimpse of another kid since he'd arrived. A girl. She had brown hair and looked like she might be a little older than him. It was hard to tell, though. He only got a brief look at her as a woman escorted her into the room right next to his. The door thumped closed just as he and his escort walked by, and he noticed the plaque on the front of its white surface. 31K.
"Teresa hasn't had any problem taking her new name," the man in green said as they moved down the long, dimly lit hallway. "Of course, that might be because she wanted to forget her given one."
"What was it?"
Stephen asked, his tone approaching something like politeness. He genuinely wanted to know. If the girl had really given up so easily, maybe he could hold on to her name as well. A favor to a potential friend.
"It'll be hard enough for you to forget your own," came the response. "I wouldn't want to burden you with another."
"I'll never forget," Stephen told himself. "Never."
Somewhere at the edge of his mind, he realized that he'd already changed his stance ever so slightly. Instead of insisting on calling himself Stephen, he'd begun to merely promise not to forget Stephen. Had he already given in?
"No."
He almost shouted it.
"What's your name?"
he asked, needing a distraction.
"Randall Spilker," the man said without breaking his stride.
They turned a corner and came to a bank of elevators.
Once upon a time, I wasn't such a jerk, trust me. The world, the people I work for... He gestured to nothing in particular all around him. It's all turned my heart into a small lump of black coal. Too bad for you. Stephen had no response, as he was busy wondering where they were going. They stepped onto the elevator when it chimed and the doors opened. Stephen sat in a strange chair, its various built-in instruments pressing into his legs and back. Wireless sensors, each barely the size of a fingernail, were attached to his temples, his neck, his wrists, the crooks of his elbows, and his chest. He watched the console next to him as it collected data, chirping and beeping. The man in the grown-up jammies sat in another chair to observe, his knees only a couple of inches from Stephen's.
"I'm sorry, Thomas. We'd usually wait longer before it came to this," Randall said.
He sounded nicer than he had back in the hallway and in Stephen's room.
"We'd give you some more time to choose to take your new name voluntarily, like Teresa did. But time isn't a luxury we have anymore."
He held up a tiny piece of shiny silver, one end rounded, the other tapered to a razor-sharp point.
"Don't move," Randall
said, leaning forward, as if he were going to whisper something into Stephen's ear. Before he could question the man, Stephen felt a sharp pain in his neck, right below his chin, then the unsettling sensation of something burrowing into his throat. He yelped, but it was over as fast as it had begun, and he felt nothing more than the panic that filled his chest.
What was that?
He stammered. He tried to get up from the chair despite all the things attached to him. Randall pushed him back into his seat, easy to do when he was twice Stephen's size.
"It's a pain stimulator. Don't worry, it'll dissolve and get flushed out of your system. Eventually. By then, you probably won't need it anymore."
He shrugged. "What can you do?"
"But we can always insert another one if you make it necessary. Now calm down."
Stephen had a hard time catching his breath.
"What's it going to do to me?"
"Well, that depends. Thomas, we have a long road ahead of us, you and me. All of us. But for today, right now, at this moment, we can take a shortcut, a little path through the woods. All you need to do is tell me your name."
"That's easy. Stephen."
Randall let his head fall into his hands.
"Do it," he said, his voice little more than a tired whisper.
Until this moment, Stephen hadn't known pain outside of the scrapes and bruises of childhood, and so it was that when the fiery tempest exploded throughout his body, when the agony erupted in his veins and muscles, he had no words for it, no capacity to understand. There were only the screams that barely reached his own ears before his mind shut down and saved him. Stephen came to, breathing heavily and soaked in sweat. He was still in the strange chair, but at some point he'd been secured to it with straps of soft leather. Every nerve in his body buzzed with the lingering effects of the pain inflicted by Randall and the implanted device.
"What?"
Stephen whispered, a hoarse croak. His throat burned, telling him all he needed to know about how much he'd screamed in the time he lost.
"What?"
he repeated, his mind struggling to connect the pieces.
"I tried to tell you, Thomas," Randall said, with perhaps,
some compassion in his voice. Possibly regret.
"We don't have time to mess around. I'm sorry. I really am. But we're going to have to try this again. I think you understand now that none of this is a bluff.
It's important to everyone here that you accept your new name."
The man looked away and paused a long time, staring at the floor.
"How could you hurt me?"
Stephen asked through his raw throat.
"I'm just a little kid."
Young or not, he understood how pathetic he sounded.
Stephen also knew that adults seemed to react to pathetic in one of two ways. Their hearts would melt a little and they'd backtrack. Or the guilt would burn like a furnace within them and they'd harden into rock to put the fire out. Randall chose the latter, his face reddening as he shouted back,
"All you have to do is accept a name. Now, I'm not playing around anymore. What's your name?"
Stephen wasn't stupid. He'd just pretend for now.
"Thomas. My name is Thomas."
"I don't believe you,"
Randall responded, his eyes pools of darkness.
"Again."
Stephen opened his mouth to answer, but Randall hadn't been speaking to him. The pain came back, harder and faster. He barely had time to register the agony before he passed out.
"What's your name?"
Stephen could barely speak.
"Thomas."
"I don't believe you."
"No,"
he whimpered. The pain was no longer a surprise, nor was the darkness that came after.
"What's your name?"
"Thomas."
"I don't want you to forget."
"No,"
he cried, trembling with sobs.
"What's your name?"
"Thomas."
"Do you have any other name?"
"No, only Thomas."
"Has anyone ever called you anything else?"
"No, only Thomas."
"Will you ever forget your name? Will you ever use another?"
"No."
"Okay. Then I'll give you one last reminder."
Later, he lay on his bed, once again curled up into himself. The world outside felt far away, silent. He'd run out of tears, his body numb except that unpleasant tingle. It was as if his entire being had fallen asleep. He pictured Randall across from him, guilt and anger mixed into a potent, lethal form of rage that turned his face into a grotesque mask as he inflicted the pain.
"I'll never forget," he told himself. "I must never, never forget."
And so, inside his mind, he chanted a familiar phrase over and over and over. Though he couldn't quite put a finger on it, something did seem different.
"Thomas, Thomas, Thomas, my name is Thomas."
Chapter 3 222.2.28 9:36 a.m.
"Please hold still."
The doctor wasn't mean, but he wasn't kind either. He was just kind of there, stoic and professional. Also forgettable. Middle-aged, average height, medium build, short dark hair. Thomas closed his eyes and felt the needle slide into his vein after that quick pinprick of pain. It was funny how he dreaded it every week, but then it lasted less than a second, followed by the flood of cold inside his body.
"See now," the doctor said, "that didn't hurt."
Thomas shook his head but didn't speak. He had a hard time speaking ever since the incident with Randall. He had a hard time sleeping, eating, and just about everything else, too. Only in the last few days had he started to get over it, little by little. Whenever a trace memory of his real name came forward in his mind, he pushed it away, not ever wanting to go through that torture again. Thomas worked just fine. It'd have to do. Blood, so dark it looked almost black, glided up the narrow tube from his arm and into the vial. He didn't know what they tested him for, but this was just one of many, many pokes and prods, some daily, some weekly. The doctor stopped the flow and sealed off the vial.
"All right, then.
That does it for the blood work. He pulled out the needle. Now let's get you into the scanning machine and capture another look at that brain of yours.
Thomas froze, anxiety trickling in, tightening his chest. The anxiety always came when they mentioned his brain.
Now, now, the doctor chided, noticing Thomas's body tense. We do this every week. It's just routine. Nothing to fret over. We need to capture regular images of your activity up there. Okay?
Thomas nodded, squeezing his eyes shut for a moment. He wanted to cry. He sucked in a breath and fought the urge. He stood and followed the doctor to another room, where a massive machine sat like a giant elephant, a tube-shaped chamber at its center, a flat bed extended, waiting for him to be slid inside.
Up you go!
This was the fourth or fifth time Thomas had done this, and there was no point fighting it. He jumped up onto the bed and lay flat on his back, staring up at the bright lights on the ceiling.
Remember, the doctor said, don't worry about those knocking sounds. It's all normal, all part of the game.
There was a click and then a groan of machinery, and Thomas's bed glided into the yawning tube. Thomas sat at a desk all by himself. In front of him, standing by a writing board, was his teacher, Mr. Glanville, a gruff, gray-toned man with barely any hair. Unless you counted his eyebrows. Those bushy things looked like they'd commandeered every follicle from the rest of his body. It was the second hour after lunch now, and Thomas would have given at least three of his toes to lie down, right there on the floor, and take a nap. Just a 5-minute nap.
Do you remember what we talked about yesterday?
Mr. Glanville asked him. Thomas nodded.
Fire.
Yes, that's right. And what does it stand for?
Flares Information Recovery Endeavor.
His teacher smiled with obvious satisfaction.
Very good. Now,
he turned back to his board and wrote the letters PFC.
PFC. That stands for Post Flares Coalition, which was a direct result of fire. Once they'd heard from as many countries as possible, gathered representatives and so forth, they could start dealing with the spectacular disaster caused by the sun flares. While fire figured out the full ramifications of the sun flares and who had been affected, the PFC tried to start fixing things. Am I boring you, son?
Thomas jerked upright, completely unaware that his head had dipped. He might have even nodded off for a moment.
Sorry, he said, rubbing his eyes. Sorry. Fire, PFC, got it.
Look, son, Mr. Glanville said.
He took a few steps, closing the distance between them.
I'm sure you find your other subjects more interesting. Science, math, physical fitness.
He leaned down to look directly into Thomas's eyes.
But you need to understand your history. What got us here? Why we're in this mess? You'll never figure out where you're going until you understand from where you came.
Yes, sir,
Thomas said meekly. Mr. Glanville straightened, glaring down his nose, searching Thomas's face for any sign of sarcasm.
All right, then. Know your past. Back to the PFC. There's a lot to discuss.
As his teacher returned to the front of the room, Thomas pinched himself as hard as he could, hoping that would keep him awake.
Do you need me to go over it again?
Thomas looked up at Miss Denton. She had dark hair and dark skin, and she was beautiful. Kind eyes. Smart eyes. She was probably the smartest person Thomas had met so far, as made evident by the puzzles she constantly challenged him with in his critical thinking class.
I think I've got it, he said. Then repeat it back to me. Remember,
he cut her off, quoting back what she'd said 1,000 times.
One must know the problem better than the solution, or the solution becomes the problem.
He was pretty sure it meant absolutely nothing.
Very good,
she said, with mockingly exaggerated praise, as if shocked that he'd memorized her words.
Then go ahead and repeat the problem. Visualize it in your mind. There's a man in a train station who's lost his ticket. 126 people stand on the platform with him. There are 9 separate tracks, 5 going south, 4 going north. Over the next 45 minutes, 24 trains will arrive and depart. Another 85 people will enter the station during that time. At least 7 people board each train when it arrives, and never more than 22. Also, at least 10 passengers disembark with each arrival, and never more than 18. This went on for another 5 minutes. Detail after detail. Memorizing the parameters was challenging enough. He couldn't believe she actually expected him to solve the stupid thing. "How many people are left standing on the platform?" he finished.
"Very good," Miss Denton said.
"Third time's the charm, I guess. You got every detail right, which is the first step to finding any solution. Now, can you solve it?"
Thomas closed his eyes and worked through the numbers. In this class, everything was done in his head. No devices, no writing. It strained his mind like nothing else, and he actually loved it. He opened his eyes.
78!
Wrong. He took a couple of minutes, then tried again.
81! Wrong.
He flinched in disappointment. It took another few tries, but he finally realized the answer might not be a number at all.
"I don't know if the man who lost his ticket got on a train or not, or if some of the others on the platform were traveling with him, and if so, how many?"
Miss Denton smiled.
"Now we're getting somewhere."
Chapter 4 2:23.12.25 10 o'clock a.m. In the 2 years since they'd stolen Thomas's name, he'd been busy. Classes and tests filled his days. Math, science, chemistry, critical thinking, and more mental and physical challenges than he would have thought existed. He'd had teachers and been studied by scientists of all sorts, yet he hadn't seen Randall again or heard any mention of him, even once. Thomas wasn't sure what that meant. Had the man's job been completed, and then he'd been let go? Had he gotten sick? Caught the flare? Had he left the service of Thomas's caretakers, racked with guilt for doing such things to a boy hardly old enough to start school? Thomas was just as happy to forget Randall forever, though he still couldn't help that spike of panic whenever a man in green scrubs turned a corner. Always, for just an instant, he thought it might be Randall again. 2 years. 2 years of blood samples, physical diagnostics, and constant monitoring, class after class after class. And the puzzles. So many puzzles. But no real information. Until now, he hoped. Thomas woke up feeling good after an excellent night's sleep. Shortly after he'd dressed and eaten, a woman he'd never seen before interrupted his normal schedule. He was being summoned to a very important meeting. Thomas didn't bother asking for any details. He was already 7 or so, old enough to not go along with everything grown-ups wanted him to do, but after 2 years of dealing with these people, he'd realized that he never got any answers. He'd realized also that there were other ways to learn things if he was patient and used his eyes and ears. Thomas had lived at the facility for so long at this point that he'd almost forgotten what the outside world looked like. All he knew were white walls, the paintings he passed in the hallways, the various monitor screens flashing information in the labs, the fluorescent lights, the soft gray of his bedclothes, the white tile of his bedroom and bathroom. And in all that time, he'd only interacted with adults. He hadn't once, not even in a brief chance encounter, been able to speak with anyone approaching his own age. He knew he wasn't the only kid there. Every once in a while, he caught a glimpse of the girl who bunked in the room next to his. Always only a mere second or two, eyes meeting just as his or her door closed. To him, the placard on that door had become synonymous with her name, Teresa.
He desperately wanted to talk to her. His life was one of immeasurable boredom, his scant free time filled with old vids and books, a lot of books. That was the one thing they allowed him to peruse freely. The huge collection to which they allowed him access was the lifeline that probably saved him from insanity. The last month or so he'd been on a Mario Di Sanza kick, relishing every page of the classics, all set within a world he hardly understood but loved to imagine. "It's right here," his guide said as they entered a small lobby, two male guards with weapons posted at the doors. The woman's tone made him think of a computer simulation.
"Chancellor Anderson will be right with you."
She turned abruptly, and without meeting his eyes, she left him with the men. Thomas took in his new companions. They both wore official-looking black uniforms over bulging armor, and their guns were huge. There was something different about them from the guards he'd grown used to. Across their chests, in capital letters, was the word Wicked. Thomas had never seen that before.
"What does that mean?" he asked, pointing to the word.
But the only response he got was a quick wink and the barest trace of a smile, then a hard stare. Two hard stares. After so long interacting with only adults, Thomas had grown much braver, sometimes even bold in the things he said, but it was clear these two had no intention of conversing, so he sat down in the chair next to the door.
Wicked. He pondered the word. It had to be... what? Why would someone, a guard, have such a word printed across his very official uniform?
It had Thomas at a loss. The sound of the door opening behind him cut off his train of thought. Thomas turned to see a middle-aged man, his dark hair turning to gray and storm-cloud-colored bags underneath his tired brown eyes. Something about him made Thomas think he was younger than he looked, though.
"You must be Thomas," the man said, trying but failing to sound cheerful. "I'm Kevin Anderson, Chancellor of this fine institution."
He smiled, but his eyes stayed dark. Thomas stood, feeling awkward.
Nice to meet you."
He didn't know what else to say to the man. Though he'd mostly been treated well the last couple of years, visions of Randall haunted his mind, and there was the loneliness in his heart. He didn't really know what he was doing standing there, or why he was meeting this man now.
"Come on into my office," the Chancellor said.
Stepping to one side, he swept an arm in front of him as if revealing a prize.
"Take one of the seats in front of my desk. We have a lot to talk about."
Thomas looked down and walked into the Chancellor's office, a tiny part of him expecting the man to hurt him as he passed. He went straight for the closest chair and sat down before taking a quick look around. He sat in front of a large desk that looked like wood but most definitely wasn't, with a few frames scattered along its front edge, the pictures within them facing away from Thomas. He desperately wanted to see what parts of Mr. Anderson's life were flashing by in that instant. Besides a few gadgets and chairs and a workstation built into the desk, the room was pretty much empty. The Chancellor swooped into the room and took his seat on the other side of the desk. He touched a few things on the workstation's screen, seemed satisfied about something, then leaned back in his chair, steepling his fingers under his chin. A long silence filled the room as the man studied Thomas, making him even more uncomfortable.
"Do you know what today is?" Chancellor Anderson finally asked.
Thomas had tried all morning not to think about it, which had only made the memories of the one good Christmas he'd known all the more crisp in his mind. It filled him with a sadness so sharp that every breath actually hurt like a spiky rock laid atop his chest.
"It's the beginning of holiday week," Thomas answered, hoping he could hide just how sad that made him.
For a split second, he thought he smelled pine,
tasted spicy cider on the back of his tongue.
"That's right," the Chancellor said, folding his arms as if proud of the answer. "And today's the best of all, right? Religious or not, everyone celebrates Christmas in one way or another. And hey, let's face it, who's been religious the last 10 years? Except the apocalyptics, anyway."
The man fell silent for a moment, staring into space. Thomas had no idea what point the guy was trying to make, other than to depress the poor kid sitting in front of him. Anderson suddenly sprang to life again, leaning forward on his desk with hands folded in front of him.
"Christmas, Thomas. Family, food, warmth, and presents.
We can't forget the presents.
What's the best gift you ever received on Christmas morning?"
Thomas had to look away, trying to shift his eyes in just the right way so no tears tumbled out and trickled down his cheek. He refused to answer such a mean question, whether it had been intended that way or not.
"One time," Anderson continued, "when I was a little younger than you, I got a bike. Shiny and green. The lights from the tree sparkled in the new paint. Magic, Thomas. That's pure magic. Nothing like that can ever be duplicated for the rest of your life. Especially when you get to be a crotchety old man like me."
Thomas had recovered himself and looked at the Chancellor, trying to throw as much fierceness into his gaze as possible.
"My parents are probably dead. And yeah, I did get a bike, but I had to leave it when you took me. I'll never have another Christmas, thanks to the flare. Why are we talking about this? Are you trying to rub it in?"
The rush of angry words made him feel better. Anderson's face had gone pale, any trace of happy Christmas memories wiped clean. He put his hands flat on the desk, and a shadow descended over his eyes.
"Exactly, Thomas," he said. "That's exactly what I'm doing. So you'll understand just how important it is that we do whatever it takes to make wicked a success. To find a cure for this sickness, no matter the cost, no matter the cost."
He sat back in his chair, swiveled a quarter turn, and stared at the wall.
"I want Christmas back."
Chapter 5 223.12.25 10:52 a.m. The silence that stretched out from that moment was a long one, so awkward that Thomas wondered more than once if he should get up and leave. At one point, he even worried that maybe Chancellor Anderson had died, that he was sitting frozen in death, eyes open, glazed over. But the man's chest rose and fell with each of his breaths as he sat staring, staring at that wall. Thomas actually found himself feeling sorry for him, and he couldn't take the stillness anymore.
"I want it back too," Thomas said.
It was simple and true, and, he knew, impossible. It was as if the Chancellor had forgotten that Thomas was sitting there. He snapped his head around at the boy's voice.
I'm sorry,
he stammered, adjusting his chair to face the desk again.
"What did you say?" "That I want everything back to normal again, too," Thomas answered. "The way it was before I even existed. But I don't think that's going to happen, is it?" "But it can, Thomas."
A light had somehow found its way into the man's eyes.
"I know the world is in horrible shape, but if we can find a cure, the weather will normalize eventually. It's already starting. The cranks can die off. All of our simulations tell us they'll wipe each other out. There are plenty of us who are still healthy, who can rebuild our world if we can only ensure that they don't catch that damn disease."
He stared at Thomas, as if Thomas should know what to say next. He didn't. Do you know what our institution is called, Thomas?
The Chancellor asked. Thomas shrugged.
Well, you said wicked a few minutes ago, and those guards had it on their uniforms. Is that really the name of this place?
Chancellor Anderson nodded. Some people didn't like it, but it really makes perfect sense. It explains exactly what we're here to do.
At any cost, Thomas said, repeating what the Chancellor had said earlier, making sure he realized that Thomas had understood what that implied, though he wasn't quite sure he did.
At any cost, the man nodded.
That's right.
His eyes were bright now.
WICKED stands for World in Catastrophe Kill Zone Experiment Department. We want our name to remind people of why we exist, what we plan to accomplish, and how we intend to do it.
He paused, seeming to rethink something.
To be fair, I think the world will fix itself eventually. Our objective is to save humanity. Otherwise, what's the point?
Chancellor Anderson watched Thomas carefully, awaiting his answer, but Thomas's head hurt too much by then to figure out half of what the man had said. And he was really creeped out by the word kill zone.
What could it possibly mean?
It seemed even worse than the word right before it. Catastrophe. He'd always thought that given the chance, he'd ask these people a million questions. And here he was, with even more questions. At some point, they didn't seem to matter anymore, though. He was tired, angry, and confused. All he wanted was to go back to his room and be alone.
Things are going to get very busy over the next several years, Chancellor Anderson continued. We've brought several young survivors here, just like you, and we finally determined that we're ready to get to work. Complete more and more testing to see which of our students will rise to the top. Take my advice when I say that you'll want to do your best. Being immune to the flare holds power, but it will take more than simple biology to succeed here.
And we have such magnificent structures to build, biomechanical labs to construct, wonders of life to create. And all of this will ultimately lead to mapping out the kill zone. We'll identify the differences that cause immunity and then design a cure. I am sure of it.
He paused, his face alight with excitement. Thomas sat still, doing his best to remain calm. Anderson was getting a little scary. The Chancellor seemed to realize he'd gotten carried away with himself and let out a sigh.
Well, I suppose that's enough of a pep talk for one day. You're getting older, Thomas, and doing better than almost anyone in the testing program. We think very highly of you, and I felt it was time that we meet face to face. Expect a lot more of this in the future. More freedom, and a bigger role to play here at WICKED. Does that sound good to you?
Thomas nodded before he could stop himself, because, well, it did sound good. He sometimes felt like he lived in a prison, and he wanted out. Plain and simple. Maybe the path had just been laid before him.
Can I just ask another question?
He said, unable to get that one horrible word out of his head.
Kill zone.
Sure.
What does kill zone mean?
Anderson actually smiled at that.
Ah, I'm sorry. I guess I assumed you knew.
It's what we call the brain. The place where the flare does the most damage. Where it eventually, well, ends the life of those who are infected. And that's what we're battling.
I guess you could say it's the battleground for us here at WICKED. The kill zone.
Thomas was a long way from understanding, but for some reason this explanation made him feel better.
So, we're set then? Chancellor Anderson asked. You're ready to play a role in the important things we're doing here?
Thomas nodded. The Chancellor tapped a finger on the desk a couple of times.
Fantastic. Then go on back to your room and get some rest. Big times ahead.
Thomas felt a little rush of excitement, followed immediately by a shame he didn't even understand.
Thomas couldn't help himself after the same lady had escorted him back to his room. Right before she closed the door, he stuck his hand in the gap to stop it.
Sorry, he said quickly, but can I just ask you one question?
A flash of doubt crossed her face.
That's probably not a good idea. All of this, it's a really controlled environment. I'm sorry.
Her face flushed red.
But
Thomas searched for the right words, the right question.
That guy, Chancellor Anderson, he said something about big times ahead. Are there many others like me? Are they all kids? Will I finally get to meet some of them?
He hated how much he dared to hope.
Like the girl next to me, Teresa. Will I actually get to meet her?
The woman sighed, sincere pity in her eyes. She nodded.
There are lots of others. But what's important now is that you're doing great in the testing, and meeting the others won't be too far away. I know you must be lonely. I'm really sorry. But maybe it helps to know that everyone is in the same boat. Things will get better soon, though. I promise.
She started to close the door, but Thomas stopped it again.
How long?
He asked, embarrassed at how desperate he sounded.
How much longer will I be alone? Just,
she sighed.
Like I said, not much longer. Maybe a year.
Thomas had to whip his hand away before she slammed the door on it. He ran over and crumpled onto the bed, trying to hold in his tears.
A year.
Chapter 6 224.3.12 7:30 a.m. A knock on his door early morning. It had become as routine as clockwork. Same time, but not always the same face. Yet he knew who he hoped it to be. The nicest doctor he'd met so far. By a long shot. The same one who'd taken him to see the Chancellor 2 months earlier. Unfortunately, it usually wasn't her. But when he opened the door today, there she stood.
Dr. Page, he said.
He didn't know why he liked her so much. She just put him at ease.
Hi. Hi, Thomas. Guess what? What?
She gave him a warm smile.
You're going to be seeing a lot more of me from here on out. I've been assigned to you, and to you only. What do you think of that?
He was thrilled. He already felt comfortable with her, even though they'd only met a few times. But all that came out to show his excitement was,
cool!
Cool indeed. Another grin that seemed as genuine as Ms. Denton's.
There are a lot of good things on your horizon. Our horizon.
He barely stopped himself from saying, cool, again. She motioned toward the rolling tray at her hip.
Now, how about some breakfast?
He didn't know how she did it, but when Dr. Page took Thomas's blood, he didn't even feel the prick of the needle piercing his skin. Usually, one of her assistants did the deed, but every once in a while, she took care of it herself. Like today. As he watched the blood slide down its tube, he asked,
So, what are you learning about me?
Dr. Page looked up.
Pardon? With all these tests you run, what are you learning? You never tell me anything. Am I still immune? Is my information helping you? Am I healthy?
The doctor sealed off the vial and took the needle out of Thomas's arm.
Well, yes, you're helping us a lot. The more we can learn about how your body, your health, just by studying you and the others, we're discovering what to study, where to focus our efforts on finding a cure. You're as valuable as they say you are. Every one of you.
Thomas beamed a little.
Are you just telling me this to make me feel good? He asked. Absolutely not. If we're going to stop this virus, it'll be because of you and the others. You should be proud. Okay. Now, Let's get you on the treadmill. See how quickly we can get your heart rate over 150. This drastically changed people's everyday lives, connecting society in a way that had never... Ms. Landon, a small, mousy lady with perfect teeth, was describing the cultural impact of cellular technology when Thomas raised his hand to get her attention. He was desperately bored. Everyone knew the cultural impact of cellular technology.
Yes?
She asked, stopping mid-sentence. I thought we were going to talk about the invention of the flat trans soon.
Did I say that?
I think you did. Anyway, it just seems a little more interesting than this stuff. Thomas smiled to take away the sting of his words. Ms. Landon folded her arms.
Who's the teacher here?
You are.
And who knows best what we should talk about each day?
Thomas smiled again. For what reason, he had no idea. He liked this lady, no matter how boring she got.
You do.
Very good. Now, as I was saying, you can imagine how much the world changed when suddenly every person in the world was connected by... Miss Denton had the patience of a snail. Thomas had been analyzing the 40 odd-shaped blocks on the table in front of him for over 30 minutes. He'd yet to actually touch one. Instead, he gazed at each separate piece in turn, trying to build a blueprint in his mind, trying to approach the puzzle the way his teacher had taught him.
"Would you like to take a break?"
she finally asked.
"You need to go to your next class anyway."
Even her patience could run thin, he supposed.
"I can be late. Mr. Glanville won't mind."
Miss Denton shook her head.
"Not a good idea. Once you run out of time, you'll start rushing things. You're not ready to rush things. For now, it's okay to take as much time as you need, even over several days. Give your brain a solid workout. Visualize what you've been analyzing while you lie in bed at night."
Thomas forced himself to look away from the blocks and leaned back in his chair.
"Why do we do so many puzzles anyway? Aren't they just games?"
"Is that what you think?"
"Not really, I guess. Seems like it works my brain more than any of my other classes."
Miss Denton smiled as if he'd just told her she was the smartest teacher in the school.
"That's exactly right, Thomas.
Now, off to Mr. Glanville. You shouldn't make him wait." Thomas stood up.
"Okay, see you later."
He started for the door, then turned back to face her.
"By the way, there are 7 extra pieces. They don't belong."
Impossibly, her smile grew even wider. Sample after sample. Class after class. Puzzle after puzzle. Day after day. Month after month. Chapter 7 224.9.2 7:30 a.m. The knock on the door came precisely at the correct time, maybe a few seconds off. Thomas opened it to find a stranger staring at him, a bald man who didn't seem very happy to be there, maybe not very happy to be alive. He had puffy red eyes and a frown that seemed to be reflected in every wrinkle on his wilting face.
"Where's Dr. Page?"
Thomas asked, a little crestfallen. As much as he sometimes hated the routine, disrupting it made him uncomfortable.
"Is she okay?"
"May I please come in?"
the man replied, nodding down at the tray of food he'd brought. His voice had none of the warmth of Dr. Page's.
Yeah.
Thomas stepped aside, opening the door wider. The stranger rolled the food cart past him and up to the small desk.
"Make sure you eat it all," the man said. "You're going to need a lot of strength today."
Thomas really didn't like his tone.
"Why? And you didn't answer my question. What's wrong with Dr. Page?"
The man straightened, as if trying to make himself taller, and folded his arms.
"Why would anything be wrong with Dr. Page? She's perfectly fine. Make sure to speak with kindness and respect to your elders at all times."
Thomas had his response on the tip of his tongue, the sharp words that always felt as though they came easy, but he stayed quiet and willed the man to just go away.
"You've got a half hour," the stranger said.
His eyes never left Thomas, a dark, unnatural gaze.
"I'll be back for you at 8 o'clock, sharp. You can call me Dr. Levitt. I'm one of the psychs."
He finally broke eye contact and left, gently closing the door behind him. "I'm one of the psychs." Thomas had no idea what that meant, though he'd heard the term psych before. He had zero appetite. He sat down and ate, anyway. It seemed as though Dr. Levitt banged on the door far harder than he needed to, right on schedule. Thomas had finished his breakfast in plenty of time, only wishing he could have another hour. Another half a day. He might as well wish for a month. But he didn't want to go anywhere with this new guy. If Dr. Page was gone for some reason, he'd be devastated. When he opened the door, Levitt was just as bald and just as droopy as he'd been a half hour earlier.
"Let's go," he said curtly.
They walked down the hallway in silence. Thomas gave Teresa's door a wistful glance as he passed it. 31K. How many times had he seen that plaque on the door, wishing he could open it and meet the girl on the other side? What possible reason did these people have for keeping everyone separate? Surely it wasn't mere cruelty. How could Dr. Page be a part of such a thing?
"Look," Dr. Levitt said, snapping Thomas's attention back to the white walls of the hallway, the fluorescent lights above. "I know I've been a little unfriendly this morning. I'm sorry. Today's project has been quite an undertaking, and we have a lot riding on it."
He let out a strangled laugh that sounded like a frog being electrocuted.
"You could say I'm under a pretty fair amount of stress."
"It's okay," Thomas replied, not knowing what else to say. "We all have our bad days," he added nervously.
What could possibly have this guy so stressed out? He wasn't the one taking all the tests.
"Yeah,"
Dr. Levitt grunted more than said. They got in the elevator, and the doctor pressed the button for a floor Thomas had never visited before. 9. For some reason, that had an ominous feel to it. The 9th floor. Would it have felt so haunting if Dr. Page were standing next to him? He had no idea. The doors opened with a cheerful chime, and Dr. Levitt exited to the left. Thomas followed, quickly taking in a desk in front of glass partitions. Beyond that, he could see the blinking lights of monitors and instruments. This floor was some kind of hospital unit, by the looks of it. Maybe something had happened to Dr. Page. Maybe they were going to visit her. Thomas tried to sound as nice and as at ease as possible.
"So, can you tell me what's going on today?"
"No,"
Levitt replied, then added a,
"Sorry, son,"
as an afterthought. Thomas followed Levitt past the front desk and beyond the glass. They continued down the hallway, passing door after door. But aside from the medical monitors outside each room, none gave up any clues. The doors were all numbered, but they were closed, and the walls of frosted glass were obscured with floor-to-ceiling curtains, firmly drawn. Thomas could swear he heard voices coming from inside one room and jumped at a sharp cry that left no doubt. He kept walking until an echoing scream came bouncing down the hall behind them. Thomas stopped and spun around to take a look.
"Keep walking," Dr. Levitt directed. "There's nothing to worry about."
"What's going on?" Thomas asked again. "What's wrong with that?"
Levitt grabbed Thomas's arm, not hard enough to hurt, but not exactly gently either.
"Everything's going to be okay. You have to trust me. Just keep walking. We're almost there."
Thomas obeyed. They stopped in front of a door identical to all the others, an electronic chart next to it with a bunch of information too small for Thomas to see from where he stood. Dr. Levitt studied it for a moment, then reached to open the door. He just turned the knob when a commotion down the hall erupted in the silence. Thomas turned to see a door open, and a boy dressed in a hospital gown, his head bandaged, stumbled out, two nurses supporting him. He was staggering as if heavily drugged, and he fell to the ground. He then struggled back to his feet, fighting off the two people who had been helping him moments before. Thomas was frozen, staring at the boy as he fell again, then drunkenly clambered to his feet and attempted to run away, swerving from side to side as he headed straight for Thomas.
"Don't go in there,"
the boy slurred. He had dark hair, Asian features, was maybe a year older than Thomas. The boy's face was flushed and sweaty. A tiny red spot blossomed on the bandage wrapped around his head, just above his ears. Thomas watched in stunned disbelief. Then suddenly Dr. Levitt was standing between Thomas and the oncoming boy. One of the two pursuing nurses shouted,
"Minho, stop! You're in no condition!"
But the words faded to nothing. Minho. The boy's name was Minho. Now Thomas knew at least two other names. The boy slammed into Dr. Levitt, almost as if he hadn't seen him standing there. Minho's eyes were completely focused on Thomas, bright with dazed fear.
"Don't let them do it to you,"
he yelled, now struggling with Levitt, who'd wrapped his arms around him. Minho was way too small to break free from the man, but that didn't stop him from trying.
"What?"
Thomas said too quietly. He spoke louder.
"What's going on?"
"They're putting things in our heads,"
Minho called out to him, eyes still wild, boring into Thomas.
"They said it wouldn't hurt, but it does. It does! They're a bunch of lying—"
That last word died in the boy's mouth as one of the nurses injected something into his neck that made him go slack, his body slumping to the floor. Within seconds, they were dragging him down the hallway toward the room he'd exited, his feet trailing along behind him. Thomas turned to Levitt.
"What did they do to him?"
The doctor, his demeanor wrapped in a surprising calmness, simply said,
"Don't worry. He's just having a reaction to the anesthesia. Nothing to worry about."
He seemed to like that phrase. Thomas thought about running. He thought about it the whole time he watched Levitt open the door, as he followed him inside the room, as he heard the door close behind him.
"I'm a coward," he thought. "I've got nothing on that Minho kid."
It definitely looked like a hospital room. There were two beds, both with privacy curtains. The one to the left was open, revealing a newly made bed. The one to the right had the curtains drawn, hiding whoever lay there. Thomas could see the shadowy figure of a body through the thin material. Medical equipment filled the room, as state-of-the-art as any of the equipment he'd seen in the labs during his tests. Levitt already stood at one of the displays, perusing a screen of charts and entering information. Thomas returned his attention to the closed curtain, the bed behind it. Levitt was a good 6 or 7 feet away from him, consumed by what he was reading on the charts.
"I have to see who's behind that curtain,"
Thomas thought. He couldn't remember the last time an urge had struck him so powerfully. To his left, Levitt leaned closer to the screen, reading something in small print. Thomas went for it. He crept toward the closed curtain to the right and pulled it to the side, stepped around it, rushed to the bed. Another boy lay there, blonde hair cropped short, eyes closed, covers pulled up to his chin. Levitt was across the room in a second, fumbling with the curtain. He grabbed Thomas by the arm, yanking him.